You're listening to OWW Radio,
the official radio show of OnlineWorldOfWrestling.com.
All right, so here we are, living it day by day. You are a superstar, and you said what she used to always say.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of OWW Radio. This is the official radio program of OnlineWorldOfWrestling.com. Each week, OWW Radio will bring perspective to the WWE, TNA, and everything else making the news in the world of professional wrestling. My name is David, and this week I welcome Larry Matisic to the program. Mr. Matisic is the author of the new book, The 50 Greatest Professional Wrestlers of All Time, The Definitive Shoot. It's a great book, and I'm looking forward to discussing how he was able to come up with his top 50. Hello, Mr. Matisic. Thank you for taking the time to join me today, and congratulations on your recent publication.
Well, I appreciate it, David. It's fun to have done. It's fun to write. I still enjoy that as much as anything. Years and years ago, I thought I was going to be a sports writer when I was going into college, and little did I know that it would be a long time in between till I actually sat down and wrote something with any depth or any bulk to it.
Well, before we actually get to the contents of this book, I would like you to talk a little bit about your background in professional wrestling.
Well, I started out, I was writing for a publication known as Ring Magazine, which at that time was a famous boxing magazine out of New York, and they had a wrestling section. And in that section, I just took a chance. I was in high school, and I thought, well, I'll send them something about St. Louis wrestling and see if they cover it. I was a big wrestling fan here, and lo and behold, if they didn't publish it, so I guess it was written okay, and so I kept sending, and they kept publishing. Eventually, I figured out, geez, don't you think they ought to maybe ought to get paid for this somewhere along the way? So I sent a letter to a guy who was also doing some writing in Ring Magazine, and told my agent what I was doing and writing for Ring Magazine. And he wrote me back and says, "Get away from wrestling. Don't get anywhere near it. It's a horrible sport. It's a horrible business. Everybody's a bunch of crooks, and it's the last thing in the world you ever want to do." So I thought, well, this sounds like it's just for me. And, of course, I didn't pay any attention to it. So I continued to write, and eventually I sent a copy of my work to Sam Muchnick, the promoter here in St. Louis, where I live in Belleville, Illinois, which is a suburb of St. Louis. And I sent a copy of my work to Sam in the hopes that maybe I could get an interview with some of the wrestlers, get something, not just be talking about the matches that were happening, but also get to do that sit-down interview with somebody. And again, shockingly, Sam responded. And I guess a lot of that came because Muchnick, of course, had been a baseball writer at one time. He covered the old Gas House Gang in St. Louis. He traveled with Dizzy Dean and Joe Medwick and people like that, Frankie Frisch, back in the days of the 1920s and 1930s before he got into wrestling.
Wow.
So for whatever reason, he took a liking to me, invited me to the office. I started doing some interviews, and one thing led to another. By the time I was in college, I was doing different gopher work for Sam and calling in results at the shows at Kiel Auditorium, and pretty soon he had me starting doing some of the publicity writing. And as I got into my senior year in college, he said, "I have no idea where this will go," he says, "but obviously you have a passion for it, you like this. I have a spot if you would like to work in the office, and you'd be working on publicity," so on and so forth. So I took it. And one thing led to another. From there, I was writing the entire Wrestling News, which is a four-page pamphlet that came out before every wrestling card at Kiel Auditorium was mailed to maybe 4,000, 4,500 subscribers. And so I was doing that and ended up doing the commentary for Wrestling at the Chase. And one thing led to another.
Now, Sam Muchnick, of course, was a major influence in your life. You talk about this in the book. Why do you think he was such a good wrestling businessman?
Well, for one thing, he was a realist, and I think you hit the key thing, and I think that's probably true for any good promoter. He was a businessman.
Mm-hmm.
Nick Bockwinkel and I have talked about this a lot, too. Because his original background was other sports in general, baseball in particular, that he was not fascinated by the glitter, by the spectacle. He was very objective, very pragmatic about the business. He was not, having been a wrestler, he was not moved by the fact that, well, I had a good match with a guy like this, so maybe I'll push this guy because he's a lot like that guy. No, he didn't do it that way. He looked at it purely as a business, and when he saw that this person was somebody who could move the box office figures, was somebody that got that type of reaction from the crowd, from the audience, that's the person that he would promote, that's the person that he would book, and that he would push the hardest. So I think it was more that he came from a different background, mm-hmm. as opposed from a totally all-wrestling background, that he looked at different things. And when I was growing up and working for him, when I was working in that office, even in college, when I spent a lot of the afternoons there, when I probably should have been in, you know, that Spanish-American government class or whatever the heck it was, when I was cutting class or something, you know, I would sit there and we'd just talk. And while Bill Longson, a former world champion, was a partner of his, and again, he had a different background, different outlook in the business because he'd been in wrestling all his life. And it was really a college class there just talking to them, and then Sam talking about the business side of it, and always remember, if you don't make money, you're not in business. So that's the most important thing. And mm-hmm. how details matter, and these little details, some a lot of promotions don't care about the details, and they wonder why they're out of business or having trouble in 3 months or 6 months. So they have a hot period, and it's followed by a completely horribly cold period, which destroys any gains they made in the hot period. So what sense did the hot period do you if you lost everything when you had the cold period?
Mm-hmm.
And just various items like that we get into, and just these long, drawn-out discussions. And as Bachmann said, he was a pragmatist. He would sit down, he would look at it in cold, hard facts. What works, what doesn't. And probably that's why, to the very day he retired from the business, he was successful.
Of course, the book we're talking about today, The 50 Greatest Professional Wrestlers of All Time, The Definitive Shoot. I really enjoyed this book, Larry. And one of the things I just loved about it was you did not just jump in and start listing your top 50. You spent a good deal of time in the beginning commenting on the recently published WWE list of top 50 wrestlers. Was it their list that really made you decide to write this book?
Well, it was part of it, certainly. I'd already written three books for ECW Press, Michael Holmes out of Toronto, Canada, my editor, and a great editor, great guy to work with, totally passionate about this business. And here he is, he's editing mysteries and poetry and everything else, and he's just fascinated by wrestling, of all things. So I'd written about wrestling at the Chase. I'd written a biography of King Kong Brody, Bruiser Brody, who was a very good friend, of course, who was murdered in Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
Did Drawing Heat the Hard Way. And then we kind of did a localized thing, the In the Golden Era, the St. Louis Wrestling Record book, where I covered all the results, which I had kept as a kid, all the way through when I was an adult, 1959 to 1983, during the Wrestling at the Chase television era. And that we didn't publish because it didn't make any sense to publish it. We thought it was too narrow, that by the time the publisher would spend money on paper and ink and binding and pictures, there's no way he could make money on something that was really more narrow cast towards St. Louis itself. So that was only done through online, through ECW Press. So I was looking for something to do. I wanted to write. I rediscovered this passion that I had as a youth of writing, which has always been fun. And a lot of different ideas bounced around. I talked about maybe doing a fiction-type thing about a murder mystery in wrestling, which Michael kind of discouraged me from. He says fiction does not sell as well as nonfiction. He thinks mm-hmm. you're better off in nonfiction. So I'd bounce back around with ideas. I had some. I didn't have others. And that just happened to be when McMahon published his top 50 list, which was a travesty, a joke.
Yeah.
To the extent, and let me rephrase that a little bit. There are people on there who are really brilliant talents. There's no question about that. But the way they're rated and the way they're listed, it clearly was a marketing ploy. I mean, Shawn Michaels, number one, The Undertaker, number two, the greatest wrestlers of all time. Jerry Lawler ahead of Luthez, Hulk Hogan, and Bruno Sammartino. Of course, now that Bruno has made up with the McMahon family, I guarantee you Bruno Sammartino will not be behind Jerry Lawler on their next list of the top 50 greatest wrestlers. He will be number one, two, or three. But the point was, it was something that everybody in the business kind of got stirred up about. Dave Meltzer, who's become a good friend over the years, and I talked about it, and he too has a sports-type background, and we'd make fun of it. We'd laugh about it. Can you imagine if somebody did a list like this for baseball or for basketball or football mm-hmm. or hockey, and they had it listed this way with only a certain number of people on and leaving off other people, just blatantly leaving them off, or putting them so much behind, putting Babe Ruth behind Julian Javier, something like that. What a joke that would be. And just the laughing about it, and as we're just chuckling right now, it became so absurd that, you know, I think I can write a book like this. And Michael and I talked about it. He says, go for it. So, again, you brought up the point, well, how do you write a book like that? And the whole point of it isn't who are the guys I put as the top 50. That is our hook to it, obviously. It's an obviously easy title. People like lists. People like to read things like that and have it spark their own imagination.
Right.
But the real gist of the matter is, how are you coming to that point? And if your list of 50 is different than my list of 50, well, that's okay. I don't have a problem with that, as long as we can sit down and we can discuss it with intelligence, respecting each other's positions, as long as it just doesn't come down to the point where David says, well, I think Buck Robley was a lot better than Bulldog Brown. I liked him better, so he should be number 30. I'd like to have a little bit more substance in that. So that's sure. What kind of led to the first several chapters where I got into the whole substance area. Well, how are we going to choose this? How do you choose the greatest ever list? How do you do it over a sport that has been in live for 120 years? That's very difficult. And then even more, what if you do throw Japan and the Japanese wrestlers or the European wrestlers, which I decided not to because mm-hmm. It was just too difficult to fit it all together. It was just enough to do really the English-speaking North American world top 50 list. And so all those things entered into it. I tried to explain them as best that I could, and I tried to explain different feedback and different voices, different opinions that came up. And that led to the whole thing of there's no way you can begin to include all the people that deserve to be in the top 50 in a top 50. There's probably 150
yeah.
that deserve to be in the top 50. So that's where it becomes, very subjective in who you choose. And I guess it's a matter of taste, but you try to do as best you can. And I did it that way, recognizing that in the end, some people will sit and we'll argue, and we'll discuss who should be number 3 or who should be number 18. That's cool. Let's talk about it. That's fine. But part of the fun of putting the whole thing together is why, how, what about, why didn't you put Billy Robinson in there? What about the Crusher? Why mm-hmm. not Cowboy Bob Ellis? Well, why not Yvonne Robert or Bronco Nagurski? I mean, all these different great names that deserve to be brought up. So one of my awest fears in the earlier books had been when I started out, I wouldn't have enough material. I was in panic that, my God, it's going to be 100 pages. You know, and they're not going to publish a 100-page book. I was always afraid of that. Of course, none of them ever became that short. Well, that was, of course, my fear in this one at the start. But I just kept writing, and pretty soon I thought, I better add up and kind of take a look at the word count here on Microsoft Word and see where I'm at. Added it all up, and I'm like at 300 pages. And I am not done. I still have a lot to say, so I called Michael. I said, Michael, the bad news is I got about 300 pages here. The good news might be I have something to say. Are you willing to publish that much? And he said, no, keep going. He says, you've always done good. People like your books. He says, write as much as you want or comfortably write. Say what you have to say, and we'll publish it. So God bless Michael and ECW Press. They were with me all the way, and we ended up with a 464-page Moby Dick War and Peace story about wrestling.
Well, I was really interested in reading this book. Because, well, first of all, I love lists as well. You're right. People do like lists.
They're fun.
They are fun. And I really disliked the WWE list. First of all, putting Hulk Hogan at number 23 immediately made the list obsolete for me. But it is interesting when you do a list. For something like professional wrestling, when you can't look strictly at wins and losses, right? Baseball, you brought up earlier. Statistics, a huge part of the history of that sport. It's not the same with pro wrestling. So tell us what kind of research you did for this book.
Well, a lot of it I already knew. And when I say research, I guess I could have gone back and looked up the same things I already knew because I lived so much of the period. I mean, I was working full-time in the office of the St. Louis Wrestling Club in 1971. Jack Briscoe became the champion when I was there. So I knew what Jack Briscoe drew. I knew what his attendance figures were because I saw him come in every week to Sam Muchnick. I knew what they got paid and things like that. So I was there and I heard the stories and I knew that particular era. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I was with somebody who had lived through the 40s and the 50s and could tell me so much. And just, I guess, as I talked about earlier, that kind of college at background when I should have been in college instead of the all-wrestling office, hearing all that background, I already knew it. But then I had to do a little bit more digging just to find out perhaps a little bit more background, dig up as best you can the attendance figures, because obviously attendance figures are probably one of the few statistical things you can analyze a little bit about professional wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
The goal of the business is to draw people. It's to draw money. If you have the greatest match in the world, oh, those two guys are great workers, you should have seen it. What was the attendance? Oh, they had 600 people. Well, great, the tree fell in the forest, but nobody heard it.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've got to draw people. That's number one. And then you can look at these other feelings and what other things mattered. But I tried to look into the backgrounds as much as I could, especially those guys in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, that I hadn't already heard the stories. The sad part is there aren't too many people to talk to about it anymore. It kind of scared me that I was almost at the end of a line, and I just turned 65. So I'm younger than Bush, younger than Clinton, younger than David Letterman, younger than Vince McMahon. So, you know, it's scary, though, when you're saying, man, you're one of the last links to that generation. Of course, I was trained by Muchnick, and then I worked with Vince McMahon, obviously, because I was with WWF there for a 12-year period.
Yeah.
Right at the end. So I had both emphases, I guess you would call it, from both type of promotions. So it was a... Part of it was just digging into what I could in terms of talking with other historians of wrestling, digging up what you could in terms of attendance figures, most of which contradicted each other. That was always hard. But there were certain things you knew, and there were certain things. I made a quote late in the book, and I talked about it. I'm a big reader, of course. Just if you're a writer, you tend to be a reader. And I'm a big fan of mystery. And I happen to like the John Sanford series that he's done with Lucas Davenport.
I noticed you mentioned that in the book. My wife and I absolutely love the Lucas Davenport character.
Oh, he's great, isn't he? And,
yeah.
And I don't even mind Virgil Flowers. I'm getting to like Virgil Flowers, too. But the Lucas Davenport, in one of the books, he made the comment, I think it was Martel Prey, at the end where I really couldn't, basically he said, I really couldn't prove that this guy was the murderer. But because I've lived in this life professionally all my life, it's something I knew.
Hmm.
And in the end, I almost kind of had that feeling on some things. I mean, in the end, I knew if I don't have Strangler Lewis in there somewhere, it's a farce.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I don't have Ty Cobb and Babe Ruth, if I don't have Gordie Howe, if I don't have Bill Russell, if I don't have Elgin Baylor, if I don't have Johnny Unitas in my top 50 of those various sports, it's a farce too. So you know those things intuitively, don't you? I mean, you recognize you've got to have them, those people in there. And so that was kind of a part of it, too. And so John Sanford, I tip my hat to the gentleman who I've never met, but I love your stuff, John. I'm not the only one. I'm glad to hear you do. You'll love Martel Prey. I think that's the one that's set in St. Louis, by the way. if you haven't read it, be sure and read it. Anyhow, that played a part in, too, because you know certain things. And then... you're trying to separate them. And I found it that they kind of fell into groups after I'd once made this whole 8 to 9 chapter talk about why I decided to go this way, why some of the people on the WWE list were not belonging. Even though many of them were very qualified people, they didn't belong in the top 50 list. And why I thought other people did. And let's talk about those people. Let's talk about people from Chris Benoit to Carl Gotch, to, as we said, Yvonne Robert, to John Pisek, to The Crusher, to Wilbur Snyder, to Cowboy Bob Ellis. Let's talk about all those people. So here were all these names. I tried to put them into groups, and that at least helped a little bit as I got to the point of actually listening. But even there, I know, you know, the people listening to this know, they're wrestling fans, they're not listening. You could throw a blanket over probably a group of 40 or 50, and it's impossible to tell who should be ahead of who. It almost becomes a matter of taste to some extent. How do you choose number 12 over number 14? Well, good luck. You know, they're so close. There's so many different things to do.
Sure.
And that's why in the end, I put it out there because it should be fun. This is kind of what I think. But if David, you and I start talking about it tonight, and you start arguing with me that you know, number 8, Nick Bockwinkel's number 18, and I think he's too high, he should be lower, he should be number 30, and then that I think this guy should be higher, well, fine, let's talk about it, and We're not going to have an argument about it. We're going to have a discussion. That's fun. But that's the whole fun of the thing. Wrestling's supposed to be fun. Pro wrestling's supposed to be fun for the fan. Making this list up should be fun, too. Let's just do it with some sensibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you know that no matter what criteria you use to make this list or how genuine you tried to be, people are going to criticize or overanalyze it because all kind of have an inability to look beyond our childhood heroes or, you know, our favorite talents. But so what I really liked, Larry, in the beginning part of this book, before you get to your top 50, was how you described in great detail what you feel makes someone not just a great wrestler, because great's not good enough here, but what makes someone a legendary wrestler. You talk about some of the key points like working ability, charisma, mic work, drawing ability, and of course their legacy. My question is, why is something like charisma, though, so hard to define? Why is it so hard to find in a superstar?
Because if you could, boy, we'd sure have a lot of different superstars. There've been so many people, and we can go from territory to territory. We can go to today with WWE and with TNA, and say, look, they decided this guy had charisma, and they tried to push him to the moon, and nobody cared.
Yeah,
it's so hard to define. I mean, part of it's appearance, part of it's intelligence. Part of it's looking into their eyes and seeing what fire is there. There are so many different things. It's an ability to connect with the audience. And I don't know, and here I'm working with a little independent promotion here now, Southern Illinois Championship Wrestling, and I work with a lot of young guys and guys who are, like any other independent promotion, frustrated because they never got the opportunity. How do you tell them, I look at you and I can see that there's something missing? Mm-hmm. You can't do that. You can't tell him. Jerry Briscoe, Jack's brother, who is now, if not the head scout, certainly one of the head scouts with WWE and a longtime wrestler himself, and very, very much involved in the politics of wrestling, and Jerry now is looking for people. He made the point to me when he was in town, we had brought him in for a show, in fact, and we'll be bringing him in for one in May again, that you kind of know when you go into a dressing room and just look around, you'll see the guys who maybe have it. You don't know what it is. You couldn't define it. But he catches your eye. And you kind of want to see what happens with him in the ring. I'll guarantee you that happened with John Cena. I don't care if people boo him or cheer him out there. That's up to you. I know one thing about John Cena. Empty seats make no noise. So if you're in there booing him or you're in there cheering him, it doesn't really matter. He's connected with you, hasn't he? He has charisma. Even though part of it is his appearance. Part of it is his look. It's all there. And the other thing, too, and as we talked about, as you mentioned, charisma and mic work and different things, in my mind, was that ability to create reality.
Yeah.
This is a complicated business. My good friend Mel Hudnick, a lawyer who's been a big wrestling fan since he was a little kid, he's a little bit older than me. And he's always said, too, this is a mesmerizing illusion into which we all willingly enter. Well, what allows us to willingly enter that illusion is that it has that edge of reality to it. And think of last year's WrestleMania when The Rock and Cena, they had one night on there where they were having an interview, and I talk about it in the book,
mm-hmm.
where it really looked like they were ticked off at each other and that they might go. It wasn't just an angle that the writers had written for him. It wasn't just something people had put in front of them. They really felt it. And I think the audience felt it. And I think there was a reaction kind of across the board. I think all the internet fans, even who are a very, maybe be a little bit narrow thinking crew at times, don't anybody get mad, but there is that. And even the casual audience picked up on that. And mm-hmm. that's why the casual audience bought tickets. Now I'm getting far afield. Can I get far afield here for a second?
Sure.
A little bit, David, okay? It's really not far afield. Wrestling will always have its core audience. We had it in the 70s. I'm sure they had it in the 30s. I'm sure they had it in the 20s. And for whatever reason, they love it. And even though they complain about it and they gripe about it and they say, I hate Cena, I'm sick and tired of seeing Pat O'Connor, I don't want to see that Joe Stecker anymore, I'm sure they gripe about that. Who knows what they were griping about? But they come to every show.
Yeah.
They buy a ticket. They are there for you all the time. You can rely on them. Okay, there's your base audience, but to really make money, to really make an impact upon the culture, to really mean something outside of your narrow field of wrestling or baseball or whatever it is, you have to attract that casual audience. And I think that happens best and easiest when there is that touch of reality, not just in wrestling, but in movies, in live theater, mm-hmm. in music. You have that one musician that just really catches you, really hits that there's some sort of bass chord or some line in his lyrics that just really touches a lot of people in the gut. They're the ones that hook you when they can do that thing of reality. And, of course, it's also easier to create reality when you are real. So for the Kurt Angles, the Jack Briscoes, the Luthezes, and the other people of that, the Brock Lesnars of the world, it's easy to create that little moment, that 30 seconds of mesmerizing illusion when everybody says, whoa,
yeah,
he really smacked him. My God, what happened there? If you do that, that takes you a little bit above great, I think. I think you have to be able to do that now and then. I think that's part of charisma, and I think it's part of the whole thing.
Part of making us believe, I really liked in the book when you compared wrestlers to movie stars, like Harrison Ford, and how he's able to make us believe during a film that he's Indiana Jones. But mm-hmm. you point out that wrestlers, quote, have to do it alone and nearly naked in the ring, unquote.
Yep.
What a challenge, right?
Oh, tremendous challenge.
Yeah.
Think about it. That's hard. I mean, in a lot of cases, not as much today, but maybe on a bigger scale at one time. So I guess the challenge is still the same. You used to have to do it six nights a week.
Mm-hmm.
Now maybe you have to do it one night a week. But boy, you got to do it in front of 4 million people, so you better do it good. And I think that's kind of been lost a little bit in wrestling as it is today, where the acknowledgement that we are, quote, sports entertainment. Well, all sports are entertainment, so I don't even want to, that's baloney. I mean, baseball's entertainment. It's not going to cure cancer. Football
right.
is entertainment. It's not going to solve the deficit of the United States of America, anything like that. So they're all entertainment. Don't tell me you're sports entertainment. All sports are entertainment. You just have to catch that certain line in there, and it's tough. It's hard to do when you're out in the ring. You got on a pair of tights, and you're trying to convince 4 million people to enter the mesmerizing illusion, to get in there with me and forget your troubles, forget your headaches, and scream and yell and don't worry about anything else.
Well, there's also a great quote in the book on page 21 from Roddy Piper, where he says, quote, "You believed in us because we were real," unquote. Now, Larry, my question for you is, how important is it not only to make the audience believe how real you are, but for the other workers in the locker room as well?
Very good point. And I think that is important, because that means if you can do that, you just raise the bar a little bit.
Yeah.
Everybody else has to bring their game up a little bit. It's kind of funny. We had a card last night in a little town called Fairmont City, Illinois here. And I'm involved in the booking on the show, and I took it for granted. I think I let a main event get a little bit out of hand, where we had some input from one of the wrestlers, Ricky Cruz, who's from Puerto Rico and wrestled down in Puerto Rico and Mexico. He's had 11 years of experience, so he's been around. And he suggested, hey, how about we turn this singles match into a tag team match, which we were going to do on the next show in this town, and we'll just give him a taste of it, and we'll end up smacking each other around to set it up. Well, okay, I didn't lean on it. I wasn't careful enough. I didn't ask for enough situations. Bottom line was, we had four guys outside the ring, and they're all smacking each other with chairs. It was almost like the old ECW days. There were like 15 chair hits at that last spot, and it wasn't good. One guy got a clean potato right on top of the head, split his head open right in the middle of his skull, Ron Powers. He's bleeding all over the place. Another one of the older guys, he's taking a couple shots in the chest and on the back. So we get him in the dressing room, and I realize, number one, we've already given him the return match. We have no return match to give them. What can we do? There's nothing else we can do. And I realized that from a booking standpoint, I wasn't happy with that. But when I looked around that room, and there were a couple other young guys there who have some talent, I think, and, you know, I doubt they're ever going to be wrestling for WWE, don't get me wrong, but they have some ability and they want to go somewhere with it. And I saw them looking at Powers, patting the blood on his head and trying to make the bleeding stop, and looking at Gary Jackson, who had been smacked a couple times, and Ricky Cruz, who's got welts on his arms, and the big Texan, who's leaning forward, and he's kind of gasping for wind and everything. And I think they realize that somehow there's another level they can go to. You don't go to it often, but once in a while you could. So what was out there that work became something a little bit more. It's not like they were trying to hurt each other or kill each other or anything. But as my dear friend Bruiser Brody used to say, there are times when you get in the moment and you just it just happens. you know, whether you're going to gaff yourself with a razor blade or you're going to do something in the ring. You get in that moment, and the crowd, the audience, the situation takes you a little bit further. It doesn't have to be with blood. It doesn't have to be with chair hits. It can be with Cena and The Rock before 70,000 people at WrestleMania.
Well, what a challenge for you comparing stars, you know, from different eras. But explain why you only considered English-speaking territories.
Well, for one thing, I didn't think I really knew enough about the Japanese people to make comparisons. And then you're trying to say, well, we have so much difference in this society, say, but let's use Japan in particular, because that is really more even than Mexico. Mexico wasn't so hard because Mexico's wrestling was on so many smaller wrestlers, and the lucha libre style is so different than the wrestling that we've known here in the North American part for a long time. The Japanese guys were never going to get pushed in the United States. And the proof is the fact that none of them ever got pushed in the United States. And I had one guy wrote a review or something, said, well, you didn't give enough credit to the Japanese guys. Ricky Dozan had this rating once upon a time. Well, where'd he have it? In Tokyo in 1957. They didn't push him in the United States. That was my whole point. Mm-hmm. And part of it was the language. Part of it was the look. I can't change that.
Yeah.
And part of it was, for one, whatever reason, the United States wrestlers going to Japan worked better. Probably had something to do with something in culture far bigger than we in wrestling could ever grasp, World War II and some of the leftover problems from there. I mean, we wanted to have Kenji Shibuya and Mitsu Arakawa and Professor Tanaka throwing salt. I mean, they wanted to have the nasty American coming over there. And really, that's why it was good that somebody like a Lou Thesz could go over and probably portray the American wrestler in a lot different area than they would expect. So that was, I just didn't feel that the Japanese wrestlers were getting enough of a push here that I could honestly rate them correctly. And if you only rate them on what they did in Japan versus what somebody else only did in the United States, that was pretty tough too. I could see giving the American wrestlers credits for going to the United States simply because so many Americans went to the Japan area, went from the United States to Japan, and they got a push for whatever reason. That probably indicated strength on their part, but it just didn't work. It didn't translate the other direction from Japan to America. So even though, hey, I bow to no one in my respect for Misawa, for Tsuruta, I know them all, I appreciate them all, and nothing wrong with that, but I just thought it would clutter it up. And then another thing, it gives you or somebody else a reason to write another book where you include the Japanese guys in the top 50, and then you can cut out some of my guys.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know, of course, the business has changed so much over the years. Wrestlers can't learn in the territory system anymore. Oh. One of my favorite quotes in the whole book, Terry Funk on page 27 says, "Wrestlers today don't know how to sell, and nobody knows how to punch right either." What a great quote. And is that really the product of the territory system going away?
It's part of it. I swear to God, every time I talk to Terry on the phone, Terry will bring that up. That happens. I've heard that quote more than once, believe me, from Terry. Larry, none of them know how to sell anymore. And no wonder nobody gets over. And there's a certain amount of truth to that. The territory system allowed you to work every night of the week. You worked 300 matches minimum a year. And, I mean, there have been people that have put out lists, and you might well have done it too, where you talk about the WWE guys, how many nights a week they work. And you get the top guys are working, what, 170, 175? They're working half.
Yeah.
Half of what young wrestlers used to work. And then, again, you'd bounce them. A good young wrestler would start in, Florida, and he's doing pretty well. He's at the bottom of the card. He's getting his brains beat out every night. He's working 80 straight matches. He hasn't won a match. But he's losing to somebody different every night, so he's learning something different. But the promoter likes him, and he says, well, you know what? I'm going to call Don Owen up in Portland, Oregon. I'll see if I get you a spot up there. And then Don Owen picks you up in Portland, Oregon, and he's got a little bit different crew. And now you get some wins. You're still working 6-7 nights a week, and you're working with a lot of different people. And by the time you've bounced between 2 and 3 different territories, you really had a much wider range of experience within the business. God, I sound like I'm pitching college right now. You know, if you take, even though your major is journalism, you really should do that Spanish-American government thing. But you follow what I'm saying. You're getting more exposure to more different ways to work. Ted DiBiase brought it up once, and I think I made reference to that in the book too, where a lot of times if you were in territory, sometimes you would hit the same town either weekly or certainly monthly. Well, if you're going into the same town that often, Boy, you better change up what you're doing once in a while, because if you don't, after 2, 3, 4 times, the people are going to get on to everything you do being the same. So now you have to broaden what you can do in the ring.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's much narrower what the guys, for all the better training, for all the bigger, stronger, and faster, be it with PEDs or not, I don't care, the product in the ring really, generally, is not any better. It's a stunt bump project, and you've heard people say it, like Chris Jericho is one of the main people who's even said it, that you know, the four-star match, yeah, the four-star match of today was the three-star match of yesterday, because they don't have enough use of the psychology. It becomes a bump, 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 a choreographed thing. And I even see it again talking to some of the young guys. They want to lay out the entire match before they get, well, what should we do here at 4 minutes? Hell, I don't know. Wait and see what the crowd tells you.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't know what I'm talking about. No, you have to get in there and feel it. You have to call it. It has to be, dare I say, improv. You have
sure.
to do some improv. And if you can do improv, it becomes even better. I'm not saying you don't lay out certain spots. Of course you do. I'm not saying you don't have a finish. Of course you do. But as Stan Hansen once said, and Bockwinkel said it, they've all said this in different forms to me over the years, and believe me, I've sat and talked to many of them on many a trip. Okay, we're in St. Louis. We're going to have to go to Chicago. I don't care how we get to Chicago. I don't even know how we're going to get to Chicago. But that's the finish you want. That's what you're going to get. We'll end up in Chicago. I just don't know how we're going to get there.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's kind of what wrestling is. I think you have to leave a little room for the improv, because sometimes that audience will not react to what you're doing. And you're going to make everybody a lot happier if you react to them and go where they want you to go and then follow the action that way. And the great wrestlers, the truly, truly great wrestlers, they could do that. They always could.
You spent a good deal of time talking about how television has changed the style of pro wrestling. And to be fair, Larry, you do give Vince McMahon credit for revolutionizing pro wrestling at a time when television was changing the business. Part of that is the steroids and bodybuilding, the physical appearance. Can you talk a little bit about how that may change the way we view the stars of the past?
Oh, I think so. In fact, I'm trying to think, didn't somebody just make a quote? I'm trying to think who it was. I just read it like in the last day or so. It was Dolph Ziggler about how, well, the old-time wrestlers, they had big bellies, and then you know, they didn't have good muscles and everything, so that shows they weren't the wrestlers that we are. Oh, please give me a break. The guy who maybe had one of the largest bellies and the smallest legs was Dick Murdoch. He was as strong as a horse,
mm-hmm.
and he was a great worker. He could work rings around 90% of the guys in the ring today. Trust me, if he could go in the ring and not have to listen to certain political guidance from above and could do what he wanted to do, he would set this business on fire, because I've seen him take an audience that was ice cold, that didn't care, and in 5 minutes he had him right in the palm of his hand. He had him mm-hmm. screaming and yelling, and they wanted to string him up and by his big toes. That is something you need to know, and I think a lot of people, yes, they look for, they are educated too by television, good physiques. And look, I'm not kidding anybody. Good physiques make a difference. Why do you think Jack Briscoe got over? Why do you think Lou Fez got over? They were built like athletes. You could look at them and see, hey, these guys, they're studs.
Yep.
I could see that guy playing football with the Baltimore Colts. Wow. Yeah, I could see that happening. So that does matter. And, again, it ties into that whole thing of charisma or beauty or sex appeal or whatever you want to call it. It's there. So that's part of it. The business itself, wrestling, has to adapt to television and has had to ever since television came in, but I guess all sports do. Hasn't football changed a lot of their rules to make it fit into wrestling? Baseball gets some heat because of it, although I notice a home run still makes everybody stand and cheer.
It sure does.
That. You know, they can't change that. That's still there, by golly. And I'm not saying that one's bad or one's better. It's just a change in society. But by the same token, if they say, where, say in this case, Ziggler's knocking a guy, a Dick Murdoch will take at some point, or a Strangler Lewis. I'll just use him because Strangler Lewis obviously is not a body beautiful. He came along in the 20s. Don't you think if Strangler Lewis were born in 1980 and he came along now and he were 31, 32, 33 years old and he could take advantage of different weight training methods, different dietary methods, perhaps PEDs, that maybe his body looked different, because he certainly was competitive enough and hungry enough and determined enough that he wanted to be on top. He would have done what it had, what would have taken to be on top today. The question is, if the guys today who've had advantages of all that, if they had not had those advantages, they'd been born in 1922, would they have been so good when they came along? So I think that's kind of a, you know, a cross argument there, and I don't think it's a terribly good argument. The argument, well, gee whiz, Strangler Lewis couldn't do what Eddie Guerrero did. Well, you know what? Eddie Guerrero couldn't do what Strangler Lewis did.
Yeah. I like that discussion about the physiques. I also like the discussion, Larry, about the championship belts and how we view championship reigns. It's changed than what it was in the past. I think it is important. I'm glad you explained why championships do matter when you're evaluating the greatest ever.
Well, they certainly do up through into the early 80s, I think. And because they were so important to either individual companies or something like the National Wrestling Alliance, which was just a cooperative of a bunch of small businesses, there's a lot of politics involved, of course. But in the end, your champion had to draw money. So whoever made that decision was going to make darn sure he made the decision that who had the title was the best there was for their particular time and place. Mm-hmm. They were going to push real hard for that individual to get on top. So if you look into the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, somebody who held the title over 4,000 days like Luthez, like Bruno Sammartino, and even Vern Gagne, even though it was, a lot of it was held with the AWA, which he owned, but by the same token, the AWA would not have been in business for 4,000 days if Gagne hadn't been drawing money. So he must have been doing something right. And, of course, you can look prior to even the AWA in the 1950s when television was young, who was one of the greatest stars? It was Vern Gagne. So there were a lot of political arguments involved in Gagne. He's a very polarizing figure. And I can see where people argue, he got him number 12. Maybe I don't think he should be higher than number 30. And there are going to be other people who are going to call and say, well, I think he should be number 2. You all got good arguments. Let's play with it. Let's see what we can do. And probably if I wrote that top 50 list today, I'd change around a little bit. You know, I'd move one here and move one there. Still, I'd probably have the same 50 or 48 of the top 50, but I'd move them around a little bit. But the championship thing, I think, meant something. It lost its meaning when they started tossing championships around like marbles, and guys had titles for 6 weeks. I had a laugh when they were making the big deal about CM Punk having, you know, 400 days as the champion. And I'm thinking, well, he's only 3,800 days short of Sammartino now, which, of course, now that they have Bruno in tow, as we said, that plug will change a little bit. But and again, you'll say, well, it's different today. It's harder today. Oh, come, please now, save me. Harley Race, Dory Funk Jr., when they were NWA champions, they worked 360 days a year.
Mm-hmm.
They did probably, in those 360 days, they probably did 50, 60 one-hour draws.
Oh.
No, they were not laying on their back. They were not doing rest holds. They were doing holds and selling the holds while they were in there, which I grant you doesn't require quite as many bumps, but it still requires something. And don't you think, while they worked those 360 dates instead of the 170 that Cena or Punk worked, that they probably took the same number of bumps because they worked twice as many days?
Fatigue sets in and
no healing. No, you can't heal. But when the title becomes important, isn't it ironic that now with Vince McMahon, as we get close to WWE, because he thinks it helps, all of a sudden these last 2, 3, 4 months, the title's really important again. So it's kind of funny how the title plays in there, but certainly the championship play, I think, in the earlier days of wrestling, the early 80, 90 years of the business, I think that's something that has to really be considered. And I think it's a big chip in the corner of the Luthez-type people, and as I mentioned, the Brunos and the guys who got up there 3,000, 4,000 days, and Nick Bockwinkel had it over 3,000 days.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty big achievement, I think.
I loved the chapter entitled, Who is Taro Miyake? because you give credit to the journeymen in pro wrestling that helped build stars in the ring, and as you call it, quote, part of the guts of the wrestling business. Now, the problem, though, is you go on to say that this one solid hunk of good talent has disappeared. What did you mean by that?
Well, there just aren't any of them anymore. There's no middle ground. We have stars. Everybody has to be a star. You've lost those Taro Miyakis of the world, the guys who were in the third, fourth, fifth matches, who really were very good pieces of talent, and you had to work through them. It kind of ties in with the territorial system to the extent that, again, different styles, different experiences, different things that you would be taught there that you could learn from these people, they're just gone. You go from a training school in Florida, you're E. Langston, you go from a training school in Florida, and you go right on to Monday Night Raw. He missed the whole thing of working with those guys in the middle of the pyramid, in the guts of the wrestling business that he could have learned from and learned so many different tricks and so many different things that would have gotten him over that, and I'm not saying he can't get over and that he won't get over, but that could have made his life a lot easier if he would do these things, these little moments in the ring that will not suddenly be a surprise to him when the crowd doesn't react to a certain move.
Mm-hmm.
Well, wait a minute, I was taught in Florida that it would work. Well, guess what? The guys in Florida weren't paying to be there, so they had a different outlook on the thing than the guy who just paid $20 to sit in that balcony seat and make a decision whether he was going to cheer or not for you. So I think losing that part of the business, because at one time, let's say you had 30 territory systems, and please, one quick, let me preface this by saying, I know, believe me, territories are not coming back. It's not going to happen. It's not going to change. And it's a shame we don't have a better way to develop talent today.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, this argument, even in the territory system, was going on. Where do we get new talent from? I heard it all the time in Sam Muchnick's office in 1973, 74. Where are we going to get new talent? In those days, you had 30, 32 promotions around the country. In each territory, you would have 15, 16, 17 guys earning a living. Not necessarily $1 million living, but they were earning a living. They were in the business. They were getting toughened up. They were learning how to move that crowd, how to make people yell and scream and have that moment. So that's, let's see, do the math. 30, we'll do the easy part. 30 times 16, 480. Then you probably had another 20 or 30 independent guys that went back and forth to Japan that cherry-picked among the different territories. So you had 520 to 550 wrestlers earning a living in the business. How many do you have today?
Mm-hmm.
50? 60? 70? That's about it. That's a big change. You've lost a lot of people. Unfortunately, I think we've lost a lot of them to UFC, mixed martial arts. I think they've gone that direction for different reasons, and that's unfortunate. I don't know if the business world allows us to have that type of situation anymore where you could support that many wrestlers, but it's sure a loss to the training and to the making of the psychology, the psyche of wrestlers in the ring, learning how to work and how to get to that audience because they haven't had that chance. So where have you gone, Tyro Miyake? It was kind of, and I even played with that as the title of a book if I'd done it. And Tyro, like I said, he's just a roly-poly, sinister Japanese judo-chopping bad guy. He really just entertained the heck out of me. And you had all those guys that in the second, third, fourth matches would entertain you. You didn't go and buy popcorn during their match. You watched it, and you had a good time. And it built you up. It helped get you more excited, get you more ready for the big main events when they came in the ring. I'm unfortunate. I think that part has been lost. And they were part of building the great, great wrestlers, the guys that could have been top 50s, top 60s, top 70s, because they had all that experience with those type of people.
Let's turn our attention to the actual rankings, because sure. People like to talk about that. They like to debate them. And I noticed that there aren't any women on your list. Why is that?
With all due respect to Mildred Burke, none of them drew enough money to be top 50. And I know Fabulous Moolah was the only one on Vince's list, but the main reason she was on there, and I think I explained in the chapter why I don't have Fabulous Moolah in there, was because actually she was a snitch for Vince McMahon Sr.
Yeah.
Because that in the 70s, really, she was the only one booking girl wrestlers, so she talked to virtually every promoter in the country. And Lillian Ellison, Fabulous Moolah, she was a character. You could talk, and pretty soon you'd be gossiping about everybody in your office to her. And, of course, when she got done, she'd turn around, she'd call Vince Sr. and say, I talked to that Sam Muchnick today, and he told me that Pat O'Connor, boy, he's getting ready to fire him. Okay, well, that would open something up. So it was great to put her in. Nothing against women. I enjoy lady wrestling. I enjoy girl wrestling. But I just didn't feel that, again, that anybody really had made that much of a difference
mm-hmm.
to push out Big Bill Miller, to push out Brock Lesnar, to push out Ray Stevens out of the top 50. Certainly not knocking any of them, and a lot of good friends, Penny Banner, I thought the world of, great gal from St. Louis, who just passed away not all that long ago. She was certainly one of them. Mildred Burke, June Byers, you'd certainly have to consider those people. But again, if you get into that box office draw and legacy they left in the culture, I don't think it was as much. If I walk down the street today in Baltimore or in Dallas or in St. Louis and said, name me some wrestlers, I doubt anybody named a girl wrestler, but they'd probably say Hulk Hogan or John Cena or The Rock. They'd say people like that.
Yeah. No, fair point, fair point. Now, before we get to some of the people that are on your list, you know, there are a few that are not on your list, some few names that are very, very famous in wrestling. You do talk about some of them in the book. Give me some quick hits on, for example, why the Ultimate Warrior doesn't merit consideration, because in fairness, you know, he did headline major shows for about 6-7 years.
He did headline major shows. His working ability and talking to the guys in the business, some of whom I named, some of whom I really couldn't because they asked me not to. They basically said they had to lead him around by the nose as far as his working ability, so that was very difficult. He was a limited performer, a gimmick performer, and I didn't feel that that was strong enough to outshine some of the other people that should have been there.
How about someone like Mr. Perfect, Kurt Hennig?
Good performer, there's no question about it, but I think that he was better as served as a complimentary performer. In other words, somebody who was very good for Hulk Hogan, as I talked about in there. I mean, the joke back in the day, because I was working for WWF in the day, was Kurt came in there, man, he could make anybody look good. And then whenever he worked with Hulk, Hulk was like a bump machine for Hulk. Hulk could put a quarter in Kurt's ear, and he'd take 16 bumps in a row and make Hulk look so good, and Hulk hadn't even moved. But I like Kurt Hennig, but and again, part of his career was cut short. There's no question that the drugs took away something that maybe he could have done in the business. I just don't think, again, when you do him in a comparison to the other 50 guys, I don't think he had that much of an impact on the business.
I thought the King, Jerry Lawler, was an interesting admission, certainly someone who has the longevity and the popularity. Why not the King?
Well, the King as a wrestler, no. I don't think he's even close as a wrestler. Mm-hmm. As a performer, as a manipulator, as a television personality, yeah, then he should be in the top 50. But if you go into as a wrestler, please spare me. The only place he's ever in a main event before he got in a situation with Vince McMahon, and even there he wasn't in main events, believe me. What was he doing first? He's doing television commentary. He's had more bigger matches since he's been 55 years old than before then. He was part owner in the Memphis territory, which, with all due respect, everybody's going to get mad, but this happens to be the truth. I was there in the 70s. I know it was a minor league territory. Nobody went there to work, any big names, because there was no money. They didn't pay. Mm-hmm. They paid $25 a night to go to the towns. They did not get Ken Patera to go to Memphis. People like that didn't go there. But I'm not saying it wasn't a great learning territory. That was where people had to go to learn sometimes. Mm-hmm. Memphis, a few of the towns did better. Jerry got himself in main events because he was either part owner or booker for about 10 years. He was a smart performer. He wasn't very big. But please tell me how often he was in the main event in Tampa, in New York itself, in St. Louis, in Minneapolis, in Dallas. How often did he work in Tokyo? How often was he on top in Los Angeles? And the answer is zero.
I'm glad that you addressed Chris Benoit, and you didn't shy away from the tragedy, of course, of what happened with him, although it did not keep him off of your list, correct?
Correct. I appreciate Benoit, that he was a smaller guy in a business that, whether we like it or not, quite often has celebrated bigger men at the expense of smaller men. It has been a heavyweight business for the most part.
Yeah.
And Benoit did a lot of things, and here's where that whole question of steroids really comes in. It's really tough. I don't want to get into it. It's like baseball, and we talk about Baseball Hall of Fame, and a recent column I just read in Baseball America made a really good point on this. It said, why should the baseball writers have to make this decision? If the Hall of Fame doesn't want them in because of steroids, they should just say you're banned, like they do with Pete Rose, and let us just vote based on the stats and everything else. So I kind of did that here. But then I kind of didn't, too, because I had to ask the question, what would Chris Benoit have been without steroids? And even with steroids, was he ever the guy in the main event, in the big match that drove the audience, that drove the show? And I think that you would have to, unfortunately, come back and say, not all that often. Everybody talks, well, he's great in Japan. Yeah, he worked over in Japan, third from the top. From the top. That's not the main event. If you're in the 50 greatest wrestlers of all time, I think you have to be in every main event.
So let's talk quickly about some of the wrestlers that did make the list. some that certainly will, you know, be lightning rods for conversation. John Cena comes in at number 31. Why is this guy so controversial?
Well, a lot of people don't like his style. A lot of people don't like his look. I think it's rather ironic that young girls love him, mm-hmm. and young men don't. You would think if young men had half a brain, they'd say, you know what? If that cute little 16-year-old over there likes him, wouldn't I be doing myself some good with her if I started cheering for him too? It also amazes me, and that seems such a logical thing to do. But when you look at that, the point is, as we talked about, empty seats make no noise. Well, they're all making noise. Everybody reacts to him. And if you look, and at first I was not going to put him in, and I talk about that, I was not going to put him in the top 50. But then I started looking at it, you know, for 7-8 years now, we talk about being at the top of the card, the lightning rod, the driving force on TV and on pay-per-views. Golly, it's been Cena, hasn't it, for 7-8 years. And even though the business has been sometimes good and sometimes not so good, Cena's been a part of all those good times. And I think in the end you have to recognize that. You can say he's not a great worker. Well, here we get into that whole, and I can get into the whole discussion about working, because working is not, to me, is not a seamless compilation of cheerleader bumps, of acrobatic stunts. That's not working. Working is doing something that gets the audience excited, and they want to see your brains beat out, or they want to see you beat somebody else's brains out. That's working. Mm-hmm. So maybe Cena doesn't do that so well, but yet maybe he does. The crowd reacts to him in some form, so he's doing something right. And I think after 7 or 8 years, almost the same length of time as Bruno Sammartino, the first time he had their title, you have to start recognizing the fact that Cena must have something that clicks with an audience. And then, as I put at the very end in the acknowledgments, I talked about Michael Holmes' son, Logan, who I believe now would be 8 years old, and another generation spoke to me. I talked to Michael one day as I was whining and moaning. I said, I don't know what to do with Cena. I've got him in, I take him out, I put him in, and I don't know where to put him when I put him in. And he says, all I can tell you is that Logan will not leave the house if he doesn't have his John Cena baseball cap on. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, another generation has just told me something to another age group, younger than some of those that might complain on the Internet or anywhere else. Another generation has just spoken and said, well, we like him. Maybe he deserves a spot. So kind of all that added together, that's 7-8 years. And let's face it, he's been part of one of the biggest money-drawing events ever, the last WrestleMania, and he might be part of another big-drawing main event coming up in this WrestleMania. So you add all that together, and I think he deserved a spot. Do I think he's Jack Briscoe? No, but there he is.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought up WrestleMania. I wanted to ask you about The Undertaker. You have him at number 36. Are you a fan of his streak?
Oh, I think the streak's just there. And now that it's there, it's got a life of its own. And I guess the way it looks, he's going to probably pop up. It will have popped up on this Monday Night Raw. He's going to be back in the running for one more time. Of course, he really was trained to some extent old school down in the Texas Territory, catching the likes of Bruiser Brody right before Brody passed away, and did some work with Brody in there. I guess what really tipped it for me, he's not the second greatest wrestler of all times, but for a big man, he's done a lot of amazing things in the ring, and he's taken a gimmick that was not his gimmick, it was Vince McMahon's gimmick, that could have been, one of the stupid gimmicks. It could have been Yahoo Jack. What was the guy? The Australian guy. I can't remember.
Outback Jack.
Outback Jack. Yeah, you know what I meant. Wahoo Jack, whatever. Outback Jack. You know, it could have turned into that. But somehow, Mark Calloway got in there, and he kind of turned this character into his own, and he learned how to play the politics, and he learned how to talk to Vince, and he learned how to talk to creative, and then he went in the ring, and even when the thing was stupid, if you looked at it on the gut of it, if you looked at the storyline, it was, this thing is ridiculous. How can anybody buy this? Somehow he went in there and gave you a match that afterwards, you know, I thought the whole thing was stupid, but daggone, for 25 minutes, that guy really busted his butt in there, and they had a hell of a match. And I think The Undertaker was able to do that. And I think taking a gimmick and making it your own, just as George Wagner did his Gorgeous George, there's something to be said for that. So I think The Undertaker, and I think put him in the 30s, I certainly don't mean that to demean him at all. To the contrary, I consider it a high praise for him, because I don't think anybody really believes he's the number two wrestler of all time. I would be stunned if he even believes it.
Terry Funk and Dory Funk Jr., you have them tied at number 13. Why did you have them tied?
No guts. I didn't want Dory Funk's wife mad at me. It's a funny story that goes along with that. And there's a lot of people that say, well, how could you have Dory Funk? And they'll remember Terry. Nobody pretty much argues about Terry because he came along later and he was involved in the original EC Extreme Championship Wrestling and busting his gut and a lot of blood and guts and hardcore wrestling. And it's almost like Terry Funk was the one who invented it, while the truth is, of course, it had been there for 20, 30 years before. Just they was just formalized with that promotion. Yes, Terry did do all that. One thing about that, though, I would ask, how many people did they draw for their biggest show? And, in fact, I did ask that question. The most anybody could find was about 4,000 paid. Well, that's not too strong, folks. But the point is, he did have an impact on the business, and he also was a world champion. Compared to Dory Funk, who people tend to forget because he is not as a flamboyant a person, not at all, he was that smooth, scientific wrestler when that type of wrestler was what the public wanted. And he did that, and he drew much better as the NWA champion for 4 years than Terry did as the NWA champion for 2 years. Huh. Dory Funk Jr. was a tremendous drawing card, a big influence on the business from 1964-ish into the mid-1970s, certainly. So I look at them as opposite side of the same coin. And I thought, geez, how do you pick one from the other? And the ironic thing is, I sent a book to Terry, and I talked to Dory and Terry both all the time. Two things. Well, Marty Funk called me when she knew I was writing the book, and she said, well, Dory's going to be number one, isn't he? Well, you know, Dory, there's Luces, and there's Bruno, and I mentioned some names. She said, yeah, but you know Dory. You know in your gut, Dory. So she's probably mad at me, and I apologize, Marty. But I still think tied for 13 is awful good. But anyhow, so I talked to Terry. And you're going to send me a book, aren't you? Yeah, you better be sure I get one. Yeah, Terry, I'll send you one. You're probably going to be mad at me or something. I know I can tell you who's going to be mad at me and who's not going to be mad at me among the wrestlers. He says, well, where'd you put me? I says, well, I got you tied for 13th with your brother. And he starts laughing. He says, I'm not that good. I don't deserve to be anywhere near that high. Well, thank you, Terry. At least he's not mad at me. He thinks I got him rated way too high. So. That's Terry Funk, what can I say? But Terry belongs there, and I think the Funks played a strong enough part in the business in that era, but yeah. They are part of those guys that are under the blanket. 13th could just as easily be 28th. And, you know, I probably wouldn't argue a whole lot if you had some reasons to put somebody else there.
Two more here before we let you go. You put Hulk Hogan at number 4. This seems like a much more realistic placement than what we saw on the WWE list. But do you think people today still recognize his contributions to the business, you know, given this family mess and some of his work in TNA?
He's hurt himself. I think he's hurt himself probably recently. He's still a name out there, though, and he's still recognizable. And again, I struggle there, especially with him at number 4 and Bruno Sammartino at number 5. And it's ironic. I mean, I've caught some heat from different people, and that's fine. It comes with it, as we just talked. I don't care. I don't mind. It's no big deal. It's just a list, folks. It's for fun. I'm not trying to change the world here. But I thought Hulk, because he came along at a time when the entire business changed. And I think it's legitimate to ask a question. If Vince McMahon could have succeeded with a different personality at the head of his business in 1984, 85, 86, in other words, as much as I might like Paul Orndorff as an athlete and as a performer, let's say that Vince had decided, I'm going to push Paul Orndorff in the position that he eventually pushed Hulk Hogan in. Do you think it would have worked? And I have to honestly say no. I do not think it would have. Hulk was the right guy at the right time. He understood his character, again, to some extent like The Undertaker with a much different character. He understood his character. He understood what he had to do to be successful, and he did it to the best of his ability. So I think that was a hard one. And as I say at the start of the thing on Hulk Hogan, he represents everything that's good about this business and everything that's bad about this business. You can make an argument both ways on Hulk Hogan, and I would understand that. And tying into the same thing with Bruno Sammartino, actually after the book came out originally, I had probably three quick feedbacks on emails from people I like and that I've corresponded with to some extent over the years. And the first guy said, you got Bruno too low. Bruno Sammartino is number 1 or number 2. He should be number 1 or number 2. One came to me and said, you know, yeah, I think you got Bruno about right. That's a tough call. I'd have him 4, 5, 6. Then I had another guy came to me and he says, how could you have Bruno? He was so dull. He shouldn't be higher than 20. Well, you know, that just comes with the territory, so don't worry about it. I thought he was number 5. I thought Hulk was number 4.
Yeah. Well, in conclusion, you do put Luthez number 1. Larry, quickly, why is Luthez, in your mind, the greatest professional wrestler of all time?
Mainly because he cut across the most different segments of what this business, what this crazy, nutty, mixed-up spectacle has been in 120 years. I mean, Luthez was there as a champion in 1937, when it was still a lot more like mixed martial arts than it was professional wrestling. It may have been a work for the most part, but there were moments when they were shooting in there. There were moments when promoters were trying to get at each other. Luthez was part of that era, and he succeeded in that era. When television came in the 1950s, Luthez was one of the major stars off television. When Gorgeous George turned it into the real heavy showmanship part angle, Luthez was there, and he was a major star. And when wrestling turned into rough and tumble in the 60s, when Dick the Bruiser and Gene Kaniski and Fritz Von Erich and Killer Kowalski were all running around smashing people, they were hitting people with chairs too, and kicking people and wrecking people, Luthez was a star there. I felt over those three time periods, along with the fact he was the real deal, he was a shooter, a hooker, in essence. He was a guy who, in a legitimate match, would hurt somebody. He could define real. He could sell real. He was a great spokesman for the business. Nobody felt bad. You brought it up about Hulk Hogan today. Nobody ever did that about Luthez. They do have to do it about Hulk Hogan, and sadly, they have to do it about Ric Flair, too. They never had to do that about Luthez. Mm-hmm. So you put all that together, and I think that gives you, in my mind, the guy who's number one. Now, I understand there are going to be arguments for a few others. Shawn Michaels is not an argument I'll buy as number one. Sorry. He's good, but he's not that good. And, but I think because Lou touched base in more different eras, and you'll say, well, the business has changed a lot from the 60s even into the day. Yes, it has, but you tell me who else was working in the 60s and is working today and has covered that many different ground as Thez did in his period. So, yeah, it's a tricky little game, and the most important thing is that I hope people recognize I'm trying to just make you think about things about this business. It's not a simplistic thing. It's a very complex business. And sure, when you get into the guts of it, when you get into the inside of it, not just the business part of it where the money, the dollars and cents go, but where the decisions are made and how the decisions are made and who makes those decisions, there's a lot that goes on. And I think if it helps any person look at the business and look at a simplistic list in a more defined way, I think that's good for wrestling, and I hope that's really all I was hoping to do, to give people something more to think about, and to maybe, if they're from a casual fan audience, take a look at it and say, you know, I never really thought about it, but this is a pretty complicated business. I respect these people more now than I used to originally.
After all is said and done, though, are you able to walk away and be comfortable with your list?
Yeah, no problem. No problem. If I did the list today, like I said, I might do it different. And if I did the list tomorrow, I'd probably do different from that. But I'm comfortable with that list. Yeah, I don't think I slighted anybody, and I don't think I oversold anybody. If anything, I'd probably hesitate a little bit on number 50 with Randy Orton, and that's probably where I was pandering to today's audience. I wanted to make sure I got one more guy from this era, and it's not CM Punk yet. Give him, he's got to do 5 years. Randy had 5 years where they were pushing him on top. CM's only had year and a half, so he's got to work a little bit more at it. And Randy more or less is a representative of that. And even when I wrote the thing, I think you'll notice when I wrote the thing about Randy Orton, I said he could blow it in the next 6 months. He could be 180 in the next 6 months, depending upon what he does. Forget about the fact that he's doing jobs for people now, because that's all a function of politics and inside the business right now. And if he were unhappy about it, where else could he go? This is it, boys. This is all you got, WWE. So you're going to have to make your fitting in there. And more of the story will be told over Randy Orton. And somebody should write a book like this in another 5 years. And parts of it will certainly look different, because different people will have become stronger or weaker. And that's fine. That's the evolution of sports. That's the evolution of entertainment, which are one and the same thing.
Well, the book, again, The 50 Greatest Professional Wrestlers of All Time, The Definitive Shoot, I thought it was a fantastic book. Of course, not your first publication. Remind the listeners where they can find you on the internet and, you know, where they can purchase your other books.
The easiest thing is just go to Amazon.com, type in Wrestling at the Chase, type in Brody, type in Mattisic. It'll all end up the same place, and hopefully your local bookstore is carrying it. There are not enough bookstores left in the world. I miss Borders so bad. Mm-hmm. But beside that, go to Amazon.com, and that's probably the easiest way to get it and probably the quickest way to get it. And past that, I'm not a person who does blogs. I think you write yourself out, and it's better to get it all together. And if you're going to write a book, write the Moby Dick of wrestling books of 464 pages of, you know, the 50 greatest wrestlers of all time. The only bad thing about writing a book that long, David, was doing the proofs. My wife almost went crazy because when you do proofs, I mean, the publisher does proofs, you do proofs, it goes back and forth two or three times. Try reading 464 pages three times, even if you like the subject, and you're looking for one verb that doesn't agree with the subject. Now, there's a challenge that'll put you in the top 50 of editors anytime.
Well, thank you so much again for joining me today, and congratulations on a really, really excellent book.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me, because without you people, without folks like you, wrestling doesn't have the excitement that it has for everybody, so thank you so much.
You got it. We'll talk to you real soon.
Thanks.
Don't forget to check out the OWW website at onlineworldofwrestling.com for the latest news, analysis, and updates from the world of professional wrestling. While you're there, you can also catch up on past episodes of OWW Radio. You can email us at radio@onlineworldofwrestling.com to submit topics or questions you would like us to discuss on an upcoming broadcast. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at OWWCOM to get all program updates and announcements. We'll also be posting directly to the official OWW Facebook homepage. Until next time, I am David. Thank you again to Larry Mattisic for an entertaining interview. Check out his new book, The 50 Greatest Professional Wrestlers of All Time, The Definitive Shoot. It's a really interesting, educated, and well-written narrative that I highly recommend. We hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll be back soon with another edition of OWW Radio. All right, well, that-